Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 86 of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. Today's guest is Dr. Stephen McGregor. Steve is a professor of exercise science at Eastern Michigan University and is a leading expert in the area of the use of sensors to monitor and manage sports performance. He was a pioneer in the use of GPS to monitor and manage running performance and later added accelerometry to the arsenal of tools he applied to monitor performance in all sports. In team sports, he's advised teams in NFL, NCAA basketball, and hockey. Specific to hockey, within the context of his three-year research project, leveraging technology to enhance player safety and enhance player development in U.S. ice hockey, he accumulated over 20,000 individual sessions, including accelerometry and heart rate data for teams ranging from squirt tier 2 up to the NTDP U18 teams. Outside of research, with his software product Achieve, he advises and manages sensor analytics for teams at the USHL, national team, and college levels. In this episode, we of course focus primarily on Steve's work with hockey players and what he's doing with his product Achieve. If you're interested in this topic, then head over to the site. Steve has now, we have two full-length webinars from Steve uploaded already about internal versus external load. Without further ado, here is Dr. Stephen McGregor.
Dr. McGregor, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it. And Steve is fine, as opposed to Dr. McGregor.
Okay. We will go with Steve. So given that you are a doctor, you have a PhD in exercise physiology, correct? Applied exercise physiology.
Yeah, actually, yeah, it's applied. The degree was applied, but it's exercise physiology at the end of the day. Yep.
So how did you go down that route of wanting to research exercise physiology and research the human body and sports performance?
A long story, and I mentioned this. I actually may have even mentioned it in the webinar I did for you guys. That you know the story of my first heart rate monitor. When I was growing up, I was the typical prototypical LTAD ADM person. You know, like playing everything under the sun, right? And so did a lot of sports. And was actually into training and got a heart rate monitor in the late 80s to try and gauge my training intensity. And that sparked my interest, or actually ignited my interest, I guess, probably had already been sparked with how the body works and trying to know more about it, right? And one of the kind of things I always talk about when I do coaching clinics and talk about PhDs and exercise physiology, that probably the majority of PhD exercise physiologists are just frustrated athletes that were trying to figure out how they could be better and then went down a rabbit hole. Just like psychologists are people that are trying to figure their head out, and maybe dietitians are people that are trying to figure their diet out, right? You get into something and you really get down that rabbit hole, and it starts taking you down deeper and deeper into the details, and the basic information. So some people follow that rabbit hole and then other people don't. So since 1987, again, I was an athlete at the time and then playing college sports. I kept kind of using my heart rate monitor when nobody else was wearing heart rate monitors, especially in team sports, and went into a quote unquote hard science. Exercise physiology is a hard science, but molecular biology. And I got a master's in molecular biology, working with bacteria, and got tired of working with bacteria because they don't talk much and spend endless hours in the lab. Working with bacteria, you start talking to yourself. So at the time, again, I was still a quote unquote athlete, still competing at a high level. So I uh, I decided to go into exercise physiology because I thought I knew everything, right? And it'll be easy to get a PhD because I know everything because I've been an athlete. And, you know, that was the first slap in the face when I went into exercise physiology, how little I knew, right? And that's always what I tell people, the master's student syndrome. You go in, you get all your bachelor's, and then you go in your master's and you know everything, right? Because you just finished a bachelor's and then you don't know how much you don't know. And so anyways, that got me into exercise physiology. So another part of my background that I alluded to in my webinar is that I actually, although I was an athlete in a bunch of different things, I wasn't a great athlete in a bunch of different things. And the thing I was probably most successful at, because I like to train. I was always the fittest athlete on any team I was on. I was always the fittest guy on the team. And I got into bike racing. And just to kind of stay fit, and I actually was good at it from the start, and raced at a pretty high level in bicycle racing. And then that just corresponded to the time when power meters were coming into cycling. So I'm not going to go too far down that path, but the point of it is that what everybody's doing right now in team sports and sensors ultimately came from two places: from heart rate monitors, which have been around since the 70s, and power meters and cycling. That really set the stage for giving us objective, quantifiable data in a sport that was previously a black box. And I make the analogy all the time that cycling is a lot like hockey, and people look at me like from another planet, but it's a black box. That in cycling, the speed you're going on, you ride a bicycle, I'm sure everybody rides a bicycle outside, you ride with a tailwind, you go 20 miles an hour and not working hard, ride into a headwind 10 miles per hour and you're working like a dog, right? So speed is irrelevant in cycling. Distance is somewhat irrelevant. It's a black box. There's so many dynamic things going on, just like in a hockey game. It's a sport that requires anaerobic and aerobic capabilities, unlike marathon running or sprinting, which are very pure sports, right? So it's one of the ones that lends itself to technology to try and illuminate or elucidate the unknown elements, and that kind of started on a path that led to GPS and then accelerometry, and then that's my research. I decided, getting back to my moving into exercise physiology, I decided at that time that I didn't want to pursue a career in genetic and molecular biology. I wanted to work with humans and I wanted to work in sport. And at the time I was coaching some high level athletes in cycling. And that's, since then it's the history, you know, and that was around the mid 1990s. And again, just so happened to be kind of at a spot in time which fit what I was doing and an opportunity, given my background, and just kind of pursued it since. And so all of my research, or the vast majority of my research, has really been in the applied aspect of exercise physiology, which is really not a hot area in the United States, because the United States is focused on healthcare and drug research. But we just chugged along and have been doing it for 20 plus years. And just so happens now that a lot of team sports in the United States have gotten into the things that we've been doing for a while. And now it's kind of a nexus has come together at this point. So that's kind of the long story about how I got to where I am, doing research in applied sport physiology.
What is it that you help teams and hockey players with?
I think, again, it's multifaceted, again, because the thing that's fantastic about hockey is that there's a place for everybody in hockey, right? You can get away with not having the biggest engine. You don't actually have to be the most athletic person from a power output standpoint. If you're smart and have good vision and good hockey IQ, right? On the other hand, you can be big and physical, or you can have a big engine. So there's a place for everybody in hockey. But at the same time, it's kind of a black box, as I said. And so one of the main things I do is help kind of illuminate that black box aspect of things. And And for, I think actually, if you think about the analytics wave that came into hockey, it probably started about 10 years ago, but it's really kind of taken hold about 5 years ago. When the analytics wave first started coming in, you'd always get the eye test argument, right? Well, I don't need analytics, just the eye test, right? Well, the problem is there aren't enough eyes, right? You just can't see enough. And even if you have cameras on everything, do you really want to spend all day going through video to see stuff that the eye test will tell you? And the eye test is not objective. You know, some guys have great eyes and some guys have terrible eyes. It's just all there is to it. There's a lot of people that I sit there and listen to yell in the stands at my kid's hockey game and their eyes are terrible. Because they know nothing about hockey and they're yelling at the top of their lungs, right? So so we provide objective, quantifiable information, which helps illuminate the game, primarily from a physiological perspective. So again, in my webinar, I alluded to kind of the front burner item that's, the most obvious thing that people gravitate to now is training load. So having a training load metric for on-ice activity, which is reflective of the physical effort, as opposed to kind of the pure cardiovascular aspect of things, which is kind of what people have done up to this point. Because if you can't afford a catapult system, which not many teams can, most teams have just used heart rate and tried to quantify loads that way. But it doesn't tell you the details of what a player is doing, right? How hard the person is actually skating or how fast they're skating. How physical they're playing, those types of things. So then we can drill down further beyond just the straight training load aspect of things and look at the players that are doing the most from an activity standpoint on the ice. And then also how hard they're working relative to themselves, because we normalize our metrics to say, okay, if one guy is doing a lot, well, maybe that guy just has a huge engine. Another guy's doesn't look like he's doing as much, but he just doesn't have the capacity. So we can tell people how hard athletes or players are playing relative to their capacity. Then if we keep drilling down more, we can start characterizing players. So what are their strengths and weaknesses physiologically on the ice, which don't always correspond to their off-ice strengths and weaknesses, right? So to this point in hockey, people have primarily used off-ice testing to characterize players. And I think what my objective has always been, and this comes back to even back in the 90s when we were doing stuff in cycling, is that I don't want to do standardized testing. I don't want to do testing per se. I just want to get the information from the activity. And the term that we use to talk about it is ecologically valid. Is you want to be Jane Goodall watching the gorillas in the mist, right? Let them do what they're going to do. And you want to be the fly in the wall. And you want to describe exactly what they're doing without actually interfering with what's going on. So I don't want to have to put a test in somewhere that's going to interrupt the training thing and you have to be rested for the test and it's going to take up ice time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the main thing we do is try to provide robust data, which is descriptive of what the athletes are doing, both on and off the ice, and helps illuminate the game in a way that I think has not been illuminated before. And we've been doing it for a few years, but I think it's taken a while for people to wrap their heads around it, right? They first had to get kind of used to sensors, first of all, in sport, and then starting to get used to load metrics, and then going beyond that. So I think we're at this point now where people are starting to say, oh yeah, this makes sense. You know, when you show me a graph, it's not from another planet. You're not like, this is something that I'm used to seeing, or I can figure it out, as opposed to 5 years ago, it was a challenge because people weren't accustomed to kind of seeing information like external load metrics and that type of thing. So anyway, long answer. But it's kind of a big answer that we try to just fill in the gaps and describe hockey, and provide in an objective, quantifiable way without getting in the way. And that's always trying to be unobtrusive as possible. It's always my main objective. I don't want to be in the way. I don't want to tell people that you have to change something so I can get the information I need. I just want to collect it. That's what it boils down to.
Right. And we've definitely seen this more in strength conditioning. Of course, like Justin and Devin's book a couple years ago in 10 kind of outlined how they use that in an S&C context. Why don't you tell us the story of what individual hustle score is?
Yeah. So people, especially in hockey, but all coaches in team sports love that metric just because of the name. And so the backstory is this. I've been actually doing research for USA Hockey now for 4 years. We had a 3-year grant that was funded by USA, not USA Hockey, the foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of USA Hockey, so that no USA Hockey money actually is put towards the project. But they were interested they wanted impact data from on ice activities, so they could inform their checking decisions and or their body contact decisions. And so we started doing that about 3 years ago. But my argument was, okay, well, if we're going to collect that data, we're going to use accelerometers to do it, we can start providing additional information as well. We had sensors on the two NTDP teams in Plymouth, Michigan. So the U17 and U18 national teams in Plymouth. We were collecting every session they did on and off ice. For 3 years. The hitch there was it's research, so you can't compel them, right? Like they have to volunteer, and after a while, you know, compliance can become an issue. And then I had some AAA teams some AA teams or tier two teams, and one of the teams I was coaching. And so one of the advantages of being a researcher and being a hockey coach is you can write your team into the grant and get a $20,000 system for your hockey team. Now it wasn't I didn't have to spend $20,000 on it, but we actually had I started using it with my team when they were squirts, and we did it for 3 years on that team I coached. And
was this your son's team?
Yeah. So I coached my son's team. Yeah. My son at the time, again, as a lot of coaches at the tier two level especially are, my son started playing. I'd been playing hockey my whole life on and off, and my son started playing doing mites, and so I was one of the coaches on the ice. And then ADM, it was when ADM was kind of first being implemented at our rink, and so there was no travel team until they became squirts. And then when they became squirts, I joined as a coach, and then took the team in the second squirt year. And coached from that point on. So we have 11-year-olds that we're putting Zephyr sensors on. And so again, it's a research study. So I can't compel them to do it. As a coach, I can't say, you're going to do this. I have to say, we'd like you to do this. Can you please do this? So I just kind of sell it to them. Right. And so, and this is actually for anybody. This is for a strength coach. This is for any coach that wants to use sensors. Cause I was just talking to a D1 coach this week, who was talking about they've been using a system for several years, but it's been sporadic because the guys don't buy in. I'm like, man, yeah, you're preaching to the choir. That's what we all know. If you want to use sensors, you have to get buy-in, or there's no point, right? So my whole thing is I had to get buy-ins from 11-year-olds. And so I told them that we were going to come up with a way, if they did the sensors, then we would incentivize it and they would get awards. And then I had to come up with a way to, so I had to explain to them how the awards were going to be based. And I told them it was going to be based on, their accelerations, which was their movement and how much they did on the ice and how fast they went and all that jazz. And then everybody's like, oh, well, so-and-so. So there's a kid in our team who's probably the best right now, he's a 15U. So he's probably the best 15U athlete in the United States that plays hockey. He's a specimen, right? And even as an 11-year-old, he was a specimen. And all the kids are like, oh, he's going to win every time. Like, no. You'll see. And you can't explain to 11-year-olds how you normalize things, right? I said, but the way we're going to do things is that it's going to be based on your effort relative to yourself, not whether you're just winning all the races and stuff, right? So I had to come up with a metric that was kind of not too technological in its terminology. It was a score based on the kid's level of hustle. So I called it, and it was individualized. So hence, individual hustle score. And that is a metric that is, again, individualized to each person based on their capacity. And the nice thing about hockey is you're going to have maximal efforts pretty consistently in hockey on a regular basis. You don't actually have to test maximal efforts in hockey because you're going to have them. So we just collected the data. The system sets their capacity level based on what they do in a day in and day out. You have a couple hard practices and there you go. That's your capacity for that kid. And then subsequent, every time the data comes in the system, it's judged relative to that individual. So that was our individual hustle score. So there's I have a bunch of stories from like one hockey team, which is pretty surprising, but when you work, anybody knows this, if you're a strength coach or if you're a hockey coach and you work with people day in and day out for years, that you get to know them and there's some stories that go along with it. One of the stories is one of the last kids I took on the team when we formed the travel team was a house player and had a reputation as a good goal scorer, kind of in-house and mites, and but was also kind of lazy could skate a straight line okay, but couldn't turn, couldn't stop. So you get the puck and you skate down the ice and score a goal, right? If you didn't score, oh well, he's out of the play because he's overcommitted on the one end and he can't get back in defense. Didn't like playing defense. So the first year we didn't have sensors, and again, kind of a lazy attitude. Tried to motivate him, and one of the ways I motivated him was by manipulating his ice time. And this is 10-year-olds, right? Before we started doing sensors at 11. One of the things I'd say, okay, well, you guys, you didn't work that hard that last shift, so you're going to sit this shift, right? And they sit a shift, and you put them on the next one, and they're like crazy. Like, in a couple of times, they just dominated the game when they go out. Like, so I'm like, okay, well, why can't you do that all the time? You do that shift when you sit. So, but again, they're 10-year-olds. You're manipulating ice time. That's not really progressive coaching, right? That's not ADM. So we're trying to motivate kids and figure out ways to motivate kids. And his dad came to me and expressed his concerns that, you know, he was losing interest and all that stuff. And so I had to have an internal reflection at that point. Like, I was kind of coaching old school and I needed to get new school. And so we brought the sensors on, and that kid specifically just focused on the reason he was a goal scorer, because he's very objective focused, right? If he's got a goal he can go for it, then he's going to go for it. So all of a sudden the sensors became, and I put the scores on the locker room every time after we download them every day and we come in and post the scores. And that kid started moving up because it's based on his relative effort level, right? And started moving up the scores. And once he got up there, then he got really addicted to it. And it started becoming annoying because he would come out in the middle of practice and be like, coach, my sensor, I don't know if it's picking me up. Can you check and see if it's on? I'm like, dude, don't worry about it. It's all right. It's one. And he got really fixated on making sure he got credit for his work. And that's when you incentivize things. You got to make sure they get their credit. So they get their incentives, right? So it was incentivized. He became very fixated on. And again, at that point, he kind of had a lazy, and he was relatively unfit. And 2 years later, he was the fittest kid on the team. And at the end of that year, he essentially was winning the hustle score award consistently. And the awards were, in the short term, we rotated season A's. So if you were the top three, you got a C, an A, and an A. We rotated that. So it could be any guy. It was never determined until the game. And then starting lineups were also determined based on individual hustle score metric. So your individual effort level determined whether you were a starter or not. It didn't have anything to do with whether you're going to score a goal or not. There's guys that were starters that never scored a goal. Guys that were the C that never scored a goal. But they worked hard relative to what they could do. And so that got everybody to buy in, first of all, to the sensors using them. And I never had to enforce it. Like, I brought the sensors in, I laid it on the dressing room floor. After about a month or two, the kids would open up the box, they'd put the sensors on, they'd make sure they were turned on, they'd make sure they were returned to the box so they could be downloaded, and they would get credit, because if those things weren't done, they didn't get credit. And I didn't have to do anything. There was no work for me whatsoever once they kind of got bought in and saw the value. So anyways, that was 3 years. By the end of 3 years, that kid who was the last pick from house moved on to AAA. He's pretty high AAA now. And that was, I can't say it was entirely the quote unquote individual hustle score, but to see the way that kid and a couple other kids gravitated to the goal oriented aspect of it and the incentivization and seeing the changes in the way they did things that corresponded was pretty convincing to me. So we give that as a metric in our system and we explain it to people what it's based on and everybody pretty much likes it. And then a lot of other teams use it or coaches use it to their advantage as well, because it's individualized and gives player an estimation of their effort level or lack thereof relative to themselves. And that's kind of the individual hustle score story.
I love that. It speaks to so many lessons. Number one, the power of incentives, especially for younger athletes. And also when you have objective data, it's a lot easier to see, cause working hard, it's for as an eye test is very different, I'm sure, than what the sensors show.
So that's the main thing, because again, because there's a couple other spinoff things, but when I talk to people all the time, when you're coaching youth players, whether it's mites, whether it's squirts, whether it's peewees, you're always talking about skate hard. We want you guys to play hard, and kids don't have any concept of what hard is. Like a lot of them just don't. They don't know what it means. So then, when you can attach a relatively proximal objective measure of that, right? They come off the ice, they download stuff, and I'll give them a report, and we get to the point where we're sending it to them relatively soon, and they would see whether they did or they did not, right? And so and then it connects, right? Then, okay, I did this. I was really tired after that session. And there's the old sweat test, right? The kids would come off the ice and the parent would touch their head. And if it was sweaty, they worked hard. And if it wasn't, they didn't, right? But but the eye test aspect of it, because the other spinoff story of that I'll make briefly is that there was another kid on the team who I also thought of as lazy when we started the project. And I told this story to an NHL analytics guy. And as I was telling the story, he started laughing because he knew exactly where it was going when I started talking about the kid used to fall down all the time in games. And it was perplexing. We're like, I asked him a couple times, do you drink? The kid's 10. I'm like, do you drink before games? Because he'd be fine in practices. But in games, he'd fall down all the time. And then we started using sensors with him, and I realized in games he was over his head, and in practices he wasn't lazy. He was doing everything he could. It's just that he just didn't have the capacity, right? And the reason he fell down in games was because he was at his limit. And the NHL guy's like, yeah, I see that all the time. It's like he coaches youth, but he's also an analytics guy, and he says, yeah, I see that all the time. When guys are over their head, they just fall down. They can't stay on top of their skates anymore. And so that totally changed my impression of that kid, because I'd always thought of him as being lazy, but it turned out he wasn't lazy. He just wasn't fast. He wasn't gifted, but he was working hard relative to himself. That's what the sensors told me. And so I totally changed my opinion and perspective of him, and which is really great, because another thing I tell people all the time is that for me, the number one metric is hard work, right? You can be the most talented player on the planet, but if you're lazy, I'm not going to like you. It's just all there's to it. And you can be a great player and you're going to have a good career and all that jazz, but I like hard workers, probably because that's the way I was. So I was not very good and I worked hard. Right. So as soon as I realized that kid was a hard worker, that totally changed my opinion of the kid. And I probably changed the way I treated him, even though I try and be as positive as possible, as you can be as a coach. So again, there are all sorts of lessons that were learned from me doing that project with my team and using sensors with my team. But at the same time, I knew a lot of those things and I was teed up to see them just because I'd been doing sensors with other athletes for 20 some odd years, right? So I knew how to interpret data. And that's actually the trick for people, is that if you're kind of new to the game, you don't have a framework, right? So I have essentially almost, if we're talking about almost an infinite framework, because I've been around so long. I'm just old. It's not like I'm smart, I'm just old. And when you've been around long enough, you accumulate enough knowledge to, you know, kind of know what you're doing. It's just all perspective and experience for the most part. So as soon as I saw the way the information was unfolding with that team, I was like, oh yeah, this makes sense. And then the flip side of that too is the kid that everybody thought was going to win the award all the time, very seldom won the award. Why? Because he was so gifted that he didn't have to work that hard and he still won every race. And that's the other trick, is that you can use the data to push kids that you think are already going hard, but they may not be going hard, right? Like if a kid is the best athlete on the team, he may never be pushed. And you may see that. Like we saw that. We started that kid specifically, we started putting two coaches on him for drills because we had to put more people on him to give more pressure. So he's getting a workout because he just wasn't working out hard enough as everybody else. And he was still dominating everything, right? So there's a lot of ways so getting back to your question, what do we do for people? Well, we help illuminate things for them, but then once they see how things are illuminated, then they can start doing things for themselves and saying, oh yeah, I can use this to my advantage in the situation, kind of like I did with that team, and other people can. There's all sorts of ways to skin a cat. You just have to figure out how to use the tools to skin the cat, right? And it's not that I hate cats, but yeah, that's just.
Dogs are better.
Dogs are better. I'm a dog person. Yeah.
I kind of want to get into the metrics, but first, how could this play out in, that makes a ton of sense for like younger kids. And of course that would apply for like junior players, maybe even higher, but what's a different metric you've used at a higher level that made an impact on a team or a player?
Right. So actually that metric is actually useful on a number of different levels. And there's two metrics that are both, they're individualized. Right. And so even at the higher level, whether it's juniors, national teams, pros, NHL pro is a different animal, right? Because the trick at the NHL is that they can't use sensors in games. All they have is the player tracking system, and there's some limitations from the player tracking system. And so in practices, and actually they're not actually training hard in a lot of their practices because they have so many games, right? So it's more of a maintenance thing. But that being said, if you want to go easy, then you don't want the individual hustle score to be off the charts, right? Because we can flip it around. Like days where you want to go easy, then those values should be low. And we use that in generating a metric. So the individualization aspect of things is kind of incorporated in the way that we generate our load metrics and all a bunch of other things. So we give that intensity value from an external load metric standpoint is reflective of the individualized aspect of the effort for everybody on the team. So even at a high level, you can flip around and say, well, we've got a recovery day. We don't want that value to be off the charts. And that actually has happened on a number of occasions where teams that I work with had a pattern of doing things right. And you know, you do things a lot of times because that's the way you've always done them. And then when we start to show them the data, they say, oh, wait a second. Like, we're always kind of trashed. And we didn't realize this day was as hard as it is, right? So that helped them see, again, it's the same metrics because it's individualized intensity metric. But you're looking at it from a different perspective. There's days you don't want the guys to be setting the record from an individual hustle score standpoint. You want them to actually have a low value. And so you can look at it from another perspective. That being said, when you've worked with people who, from a motivation standpoint, it gets back to, if you're trying to motivate people, they have to be close enough. If you think about it in a race, right? So if you're in a running race, and somebody's a mile ahead of you and you know there's no way you're ever going to catch them, it kind of is not motivating, right? So if you're in a chase, you want to have somebody that's just within reach. So if you actually go a little bit harder, you can catch them, right? So in some cases, even at the high levels, you'll have guys that are kind of at the back of the pack and they may be thought of as lazy, but a lot of times it's just because they don't have the capacity, right? But then the motivation becomes an issue because they're always at the back of the pack, and like, why should I motivate myself? Because I'm never going to catch the pack, right? And you can use that individualized metric to say, okay, we're going to judge you based on you, right? And the way that you're going to get better is giving a consistent effort and the best that you can give relative to yourself. Ignore everybody else, okay? Don't get totally despondent that you're not catching the guys that are in front of you, and just try and do as well as you can relative to yourself. And when you do that, you'll become incrementally better, and that gap between you and the guys in front of you will get smaller. And at some point, you may be able to close that gap, right? Right now, that gap looks insurmountable, but think of it over the long haul. And it's difficult for an athlete to see that big picture, right? Because they're in the middle of it. It's very emotional for one thing, right? Because when you're day in and day out, if you're working your tail off, and even if you're not giving your 100%, 90% still hurts, right? You're giving 9% every day. Like, that's still hard. So that is a trick that I've seen some coaches use with this system, is like, that we'll point out, we'll say, well, this kid, he's at the back, but he could probably give a little bit more, but the trick is that he may not see that giving that more is going to make much difference, right? So, and in one case, there was an athlete with a pretty high level team we were working with that they pointed that out to him. They said, here's your individual hustle score, right? And we look at you relative to everybody else. I don't think you're lazy. I think you can do more. But when the score goes up, that'll show that you're doing more. And sure enough, the next week his scores went up and consistently, and he started making progress. And so sometimes you can help people get out of a rut by using that score as well. And it's not necessarily motivation to win a competition. It's actually just motivation to improve yourself relative to yourself.
I want to get in a bit into what you look at with individual hustle score, or what misconceptions do we have about what hard work looks like? Like, when I think of hard work, I think we think of, you know, the player who just, his feet are always moving 100 miles an hour. He might necessarily be going that fast. And we have these perceptions about kids who work hard and kids who don't. Where has, just from seeing all this data from different levels, different age groups, different teams, made you change how you think about hard work?
I don't think it's changed too much of my view. I think that I think probably part of it is because I've just been around so long, right? So that I kind of expected some things, and since we've been doing it at a high level, I those things, in for most part, are affirmed, right? That probably moving your feet is going to result in a pretty good individual hustle score. The flip side of that is that, again, hard work a lot of times isn't enough. It just isn't, you know, that you want to elicit hard work, but you also want to elicit smart work, right? So the other part of it is that as a coach, you kind of set the tone for what you want. And there's a couple of smart coaches that I work with that are very in tune with the sensor information, right? And they'll say that they want to modulate the effort levels of the players so that they are playing their best on Saturday, and not necessarily giving their best effort on a Thursday, right? So using the tools at their disposal to modulate those efforts, then by changing out drills based on the objective quantifiable information. I think that's the thing that, not necessarily that I've learned, but I think I've helped some people learn and they've taken to, is that you can have three or four different drills that will accomplish the same tactical objective, but will provide a different loading parameter. And coaches, hockey coaches, are generally not exercise physiologists. Like, that's when I coach a hockey team, that's what I'm always thinking about. I'm always thinking about, how am I developing my players physiologically at the same time I'm developing the tactical aspects of things, right? And I always talk about, when we were on the ice, again, to me, as a youth hockey coach, the most valuable thing on the planet is ice time, right? So there's no wasted ice time in our practices that I ran. I didn't want to spend more than a minute or two explaining a drill between drills, just to kind of give you the deal points and then go and do it. And then, but at the same time, also thinking about what are the things we're trying to develop physiologically. You know, we're trying to develop absolute speed on this day, quickness, agility, or hockey IQ in a way that's maintaining a physiological stress, et cetera, et cetera. So, hockey coaches, for the most part, are not exercise physiologists, and a lot of times they're not even strength coaches, right? So they're not thinking about those things. But once you present those things to them and say, hey, coach, these are five drills that accomplish the same tactical objective, but the physical loading from those five drills is different. So if you have a game on Saturday, you may want to use drill five versus drill one, right? Because it's going to stimulate them physiologically a certain way or give them a break. So the point is, I think using objective quantifiable information allows coaches to modulate the loading patterns in a way that they may not have realized before, right? And once you make it relatively straightforward for them, because let's face it, there's a lot of stuff a coach has got to do. You know, you got to build a training, you got to build a practice plan. You have tactical objectives, strategic objectives, skill development objectives, and then adding physiological stuff on top of it. That's a lot to think about. So just making it as simple as possible, but in a way that at the end of the day is still going towards modulating those load patterns to provide optimization down the road is the main thing. So, and again, I don't think it's necessarily something that I've learned. It's something that I've always thought about. And I've learned ways to present it to people. I think that's probably the key thing, is that I've learned ways to present it to people, which is more kind of palatable to people rather than me giving them something that is the way I think about it, giving them something that's a way that they can think about it and in their framework, right? Because again, hockey coaches are hockey coaches. They're not physiologists.
When you work with teams, you help with the off-ice stuff also? So will a team wear the sensors while they're working out also?
Yeah. So, pardon me. I recommend, and I think for the most part, teams want to get as much information as possible, right? So the off-ice is just as important as the on-ice. And actually, a lot of times, the smart strength coaches, and I've been fortunate because I shouldn't say that. So the high level teams generally have dedicated strength guys, right? So they're thinking about that, but you have teams in the middle that may not have the dedicated strength guy, right? So the strength guy, as he can see the data come into the system and see, well, here is the on ice loading pattern that we saw. And the strength guy can say, well, this is what our loads look like based on what we've been doing. And this week is the on ice stuff is a little bit higher than I expected. So we're going to back off the off ice, right? So a lot of times the head coach is going to dictate what happens on the ice. And then the strength coach can see that and essentially respond to that and say, okay, I see what they're doing on the ice. Okay. That's not enough. We're going to do more this week. Or I see what they're doing on the ice. That's way more than I expected. We're going to change gears and we're going to back off this week. And so by having both the on ice and off ice information allows the strength coach to modulate the loads in a way that the head coach may not be thinking about, right? Because again, the head coach has got a zillion things on his plate he's trying to figure out, primarily tactical considerations and the team he's trying to think about that's immediately in front of him, right? Whereas the strength coach is thinking about keeping the athletes fresh, but also keeping them fit. So off and off, I think having both on and off ice is critical. I think you have both of them is critical, and most people we work with are doing both.
And the data just makes the whole kind of the team of coaches, whether the strength coach, the, yep. You know, we have in the NHL a lot of job titles now are performance coaches because right. that's incorporated into that. And it's seeing how the industry is now like sports coaches and strength coaches aren't as separate as maybe they were 10 years ago because they're all working together.
Right. I think a couple of the teams that I think of, the strength coaches are actually on the ice, right? They were hired in as director of sports science, strength guys, strength and conditioning guys, but they're with a hockey background, which is also something that I don't know if it's changing or just I hadn't seen it before, but now it's more people that were hockey guys. They played hockey. They can skate. So they'll be on the ice doing something. And the nice thing about that is that they'll get a handle on what's going on the ice, maybe in a more intimate fashion before they go to the off ice or they knew what they did yesterday, but having the objective data allows them to see it and present it in a more actionable way. And a lot of times the differences may not be apparent, you know, again, on the ice. And so then you see it like, oh, striking, like, wow, that we were on the ice for 2 hours yesterday. I didn't realize that was that long a practice, right? Or we did that one drill twice as long as I thought we were going to do it. And that drill really kills them, right? So they're going to be really tired today, which that may be the objective. There's lots of times you want to overreach a group, right? So it's like, yeah, we're going to bury them this week and we won't worry about how they play in the weekend because we don't care about the games in the weekend. We care about 2 or 3 weeks down the road. So, yeah. So I think that the coaching staffs are generally more integrated at this point. The teams that I'm working with are day in and day out. The strength guys are in there with the coaches and maybe on the ice, as opposed to, again, previously, I saw teams where the strength guys were just strength guys and they may not even had a hockey background at all. They just were strength guys. So I don't know if it's a general trend that's become more common, but I've seen it more with the teams we're working with. An integration of both strength or sports science and performance.
Steve, why don't you tell us about your company, Achieve Sensor Analytics, who you work with, and where people can learn more?
Okay, so yeah, my product is actually Achieve. The company is I formed a company just this past year. And based off the work we were doing in the past on a research or consulting basis. And so it's called Sport Performance Technologies. We developed an analytics platform called Achieve. I'm partnering with a software company that is what we call a virtual coaching platform. So akin to other products where you deliver strength and conditioning virtually, which is just blown up the past couple months, right? For obvious reasons. So that company's Max One, which is the virtual coaching platform piece. And I'm partnering with them as the analytics platform for sensor data. And so all the things we've been talking about with regard to external load metrics, which are the prime thing I pay attention to because there's more detail than there is with the internal load. We manage data from any number of systems, work with Catapult, work with Polar, work with Zephyr, whatever. Well, we pull the data in the system, we slice it and dice it and present it in different ways. But I think our main thing that our main feature is that we individualize the metrics. So again, the individual household score is a piece of that, but it's individualization, which is really important. So you know that each person from an external load standpoint, you're seeing what they're doing relative to themselves and what the team does collectively relative to what the team does, right? So other metrics a lot are more absolute and you have to put things in a context. So forwards typically have this number and defensemen have this number. Like, well, no, the defensemen have this number because it's relative to them and they should all be on the same scale if they're all doing the same drills. So anyway, that's the company. And I know you had a link to the web landing page by my webinar that was posted yesterday, and feel free to go there, shoot me an email or schedule a meeting if you want to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, so much once again. Why don't you just wrap up by talking? You've been gracious enough. You did a webinar for the website, and you're going to be doing more. Why don't you just touch on what you're talking about in those webinars and what people can look forward to?
Yeah, so the first webinar was the internal versus external load. And I think, again, that's as I say in the webinar, it's relatively rudimentary the way it's presented, just because I think we need to lay a foundation to make sure everybody's kind of on the same footing or the same a level playing field. I talked to a number of different people at all levels, some really, really sophisticated people from a sensor analytics standpoint, and then some other people who actually don't necessarily understand what they're looking at from an analytics standpoint. And I just try to get the most accurate data or information to them. So the first one was a relatively rudimentary one. The next one will be an evolution into how we then use internal and external load in hockey. So the examples will be all hockey based in the next edition or the next installment, looking at both internal and external load, what the differences are and how we can discriminate a certain interpretation from another one. So if you're thinking about fatigue is more likely in one scenario versus another scenario, that which you can discern based on the internal and external load that's coming in the system, contrasting practices and games and other things. And then going forward, we're just going to kind of continue to get deeper and hopefully more sophisticated on how to use sensor information to inform hockey training decisions.
So if you're looking to learn more about analytics in general and what Steve's doing and how it's applicable to us as strength coaches, then you can go check out those webinars on the website. Steve, once again, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for the webinars. Any closing thoughts for the audience?
No, thanks for having me, David, and thanks for being so gracious. I think that I'm looking forward to the affiliation with HSC, and hoping to engage with the community and help them learn more about using sensors to inform their training.
Awesome. All right, Steve, thank you once again, and we will talk soon.
Sounds good. Take care, David.
Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. As always, you can find links to everything on the website, hockeystrengthcondition.com. You can also check out Dr. McGregor's first two parts of his webinar series on internal versus external load. Thanks again, guys.